Testing, testing. 1, 2, 3. We're back. We're 100 times back. Welcome to the Backlit Cinema Podcast. I'm your host, Zoe. That's Z-O or Z-O, if you're outside of the United States. Taking a look back at the movies of yesteryear. Happy New Year, and welcome to the year 2023. That's right. It's the 100th episode. Thank you for downloading and streaming. We really appreciate it. We watch movies that I loved when I was growing up in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And if you like the show, then rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podchaser.com, or your favorite podcast app. Finally, please follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, and Mastodon. You can find the details in the show notes. And now, as part of this special 100th episode. That's right. This is the special 100th episode, and I have a very special guest. Please let me reintroduce my very special, my very original, my very first co-host with the most, my son, Zach.
Yes, I am back. Yes, indeed.
Yes, he was able to work our schedules out, and Zach has agreed to making a special appearance on this 100th episode, and we're going to talk about a most interesting movie. The reason that we looked at this movie is that I wanted to do this movie specifically with him actually on the show, and not me just referencing him as I do the show, is that this movie has some similarities with a movie that we had just seen recently, a movie that just came out. So why don't you tell the audience the movie that we just watched?
We had watched Terminator 2, Judgment Day.
Terminator 2. So let's get into Terminator 2 and the opening credits. Sarah Connor is preparing her son, John, for a future that may never come. A future where humanity is struggling for its very existence, fighting against machines bent on destroying mankind. Sarah's work is suddenly interrupted as the machines have once again sent cyborgs from the future. The last time they tried to kill her, but this time her son has been targeted for termination. Why don't you tell them when this movie came out?
This was released on July 3rd, 1991, produced by Caroco Pictures, Pacific Western, Lightstorm Entertainment. It grossed over $205 million in the U.S. and Canada and over $520 million worldwide on a $102 million budget. Great reviews.
Yeah, $102 million. I thought it grossed $205 here and it was made for $102. So I actually thought it had made way more money over here, but it didn't. But it was saved by international box office.
I mean, so, it made enough good money over here, so
yeah, it made twice its budget, but that's not accounting for like the marketing. I think that with the marketing, it probably just broke even, and it had a lot of special marketing too. Like when they made the first trailer, they didn't use clips from the movie. It was James Cameron who decided to have have somebody film an entirely new scene that wasn't in the movie. It was a scene that was not in the movie, and that's what he used for the trailer. It was basically to help the audiences acclimate to the idea of there being multiple Terminators. So that I'm sure that added to the budget. So that's one of the things. So I don't know exactly how much they spent on marketing, but it looks like they probably, if it was just the US and Canada, it looked probably like it just broke even, but they made the money back on the worldwide distribution and like the DVD sales. The DVD sales on something like this probably was through the roof. So, and then the merchandising, where the real money from the movie is made. T-shirts and costumes and mugs and all sorts of things. So why don't you let them know who's starring in this movie?
So we have Arnold Schwarzenegger as Cyber-9 System T-800 Model 101, a.k.a. Uncle Bob. I'm guessing he was also in Maggie, Killing Gunther, and Iron Mask.
Yeah, some of the lesser known movies that he was in. Maggie was a movie I hadn't seen any of these, but I particularly want to see Maggie because it's him trying to protect his daughter who happens to be a zombie or a zombie like creature. That looks like an interesting premise. Also in this movie is Linda Hamilton. She plays Sarah Connor. She was in Dante's Peak, Missing in America, and Broken. Not a lot of huge, well-known films, but she's been busy in the intervening years.
Then we have Edward Furlong. He was John Connor. He was also in American History X and The Green Hornet that came out in 2011.
Yeah, not a whole lot of movies that we might know about, but he was in one of the Crow sequels. He was in one of those at playing the Crow. Up next is Robert Patrick. He played Cyberdyne Systems T-1000. He's also in The Faculty, Fire in the Sky, and The Marine, the one with John Cena.
All right. We have Earl Bowen.
Sounds good to me.
He was Dr. Silberman. Is that right? Yeah. He was also in The Man with Two Brains, Alien Nation, and he was also Lost in Voices for animation and games.
Yeah, I think he spent a greater portion of in his career as a voice actor. And if you've played any video games or you've watched any animation, you've probably heard his voice.
I'm just going to take a wild guess. He was probably a scientist in those games.
Oh, I have no idea.
I'm just going to take a wild guess.
I mean, he may have been. Up next is Joe Morton. He played Miles Dyson. He's also been in Speed, Paycheck, and Justice League.
Then we have S. Epitha Murchison. They played Teresa Dyson. She was in Jacob's Ladder, Lincoln, and Navy SEALs.
Jacob's Ladder.
Oh, Jacob's Ladder. Yeah. Oh.
That's right. What you call it? She's you recognize her from Law and Order and a bunch of other cop shows that I've been on, usually playing like some kind of police chief or something or other. But so Joel Morton, he was the scientist that Sarah Connor was going to kill, and Epitha was his wife.
All right.
This movie. Let us know who directed this movie.
This was directed by James Cameron. You may know him as the director for Avatar, Titanic, True Lies, and Aliens.
Yeah, he's almost nothing but hits. I mean, like, there was one movie I didn't put on here that I'm going to name later that didn't make as much money as many of his other movies. But it's still a critically acclaimed movie. It's one of those movies where it's like the extended version was a little bit better than the
I'm just going to guess it was like Aliens 3, Aliens 2.
We're going to get it. We're going to get to it. He directed Aliens, but just Aliens. He didn't direct like the other movies. So this movie is written by James Cameron and William Wisher. So they're basically writing partners. James Cameron, really, he writes most of his own movies. He's not the type that will direct a movie that somebody else wrote. He might write a movie for somebody else, but I've never really seen him direct a movie that somebody else wrote. So as an example, he wrote the screenplay for Alita Battle Angel, and he also wrote and created the Dark Angel TV show. And the movie that I was alluding to was The Abyss, which, you know, wasn't great like the first time around in theaters, but if you got like the extended version, it was better. And then we have William Wisher. He wrote Judge Dredd, The 13th Warrior, and some movie I never heard of called IT. So what's the music like on here?
Music is by Brad Fidel. Fidel. He made music for 105. Oh, well, he was 105 composers credit.
Johnny Mnemonic.
Mnemonic. Okay. Johnny Mnemonic.
The M is silent.
Oh, American language, I swear. Striking Distance and Gladiator.
Yeah, yeah. He's the theme for this movie is absolutely iconic. Like, as soon as you hear dun 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 dun, dun it gets you ready. It gets the blood going. So that's it for the opening credits. And enjoying the show, please remember that you can get t-shirts, hoodies, mugs, face masks, jerseys, and more at our website, backlickcinema.com/shop. Also, there are links to teespring.com and tpublic.com at backlickcinema.com. And in particular, as I say every week, the pint glasses are totally awesome, and they're only available at Teespring. As far as I know, I need to keep checking and see, maybe they'll be available somewhere else. But so far, we're just at Teespring. So that's it for the announcements. And now we're going to talk about our favorite parts. All right, we're back to talk about our favorite parts of the movie. Zachary, why don't you start us off? We just watched it. What part comes to mind? What springs to mind?
So, of course, it's going to be the beginning of the movie, which is iconic, where you see them fighting a war, Sarah Connor voicing over, talking about, oh, yeah, a nuclear bomb went off, and this year humanity is trying to fight back to the machines. It's not going well, but my son decided to send his father back in time so that way he can continue on. But then after we succeeded, a new plan was discovered where they was going to send another Terminator back, but this time for him as a kid. So he decided to send someone else back to protect him as a kid. And then we get Schwarzenegger coming in through his time portal, which, again, one unique thing I would say is from the first one to the second one, in the first one, you don't see no damage when they coming through the time.
Right.
But in the second one, like, yeah, you see that little ditch right there? Yeah, that's what caused it. Them coming through time through that little magnetic, yeah, that's what caused it.
Right.
Now, you know, it can do damage if you're near it. Which right. is like, okay, I guess, but...
The other thing is that they didn't actually show, like, the globe or the bubble.
Yeah, they didn't show that either, but it's like, now you see the glow, yeah, right. And you also see damage.
Right, right.
He comes in, goes into the, at a pub.
Yeah.
Goes in, looks around, scanning people, find one guy, he's like, I want your clothes, I want your jacket, your boots, and your motorcycle. And the guy's like, yeah, right, takes his cigar, puts on him, like, this is not hurting him.
Right, right. Oh, also, you forgot to mention that he was buck naked.
Yeah. For some reason, clothes aren't allowed to go through. You have to be completely butt naked, and I'm just like, I guess, whatever, sure.
Well, we just watched the first movie yesterday, so.
I know, because they said nothing non-organic can go through, but I'm
nothing,
like.
Well, the guy described it as nothing dead will go.
Yeah, nothing dead will go. I'm like, oh, yeah. Nothing dead.
And the doctor was like, yeah, but you said he was a robot. He's covered with living tissue. Don't you understand? You're all going to die.
He was like, right, living tissue. Forgot that part. How do you forget that part? He clearly just told you.
Because you don't believe him.
I mean, no. That's understandable.
Yeah, so that first bar fight, yeah, that was pretty awesome.
Everyone got there. But like, the guy that had to give up his clothes, thrown onto the grill. I'm like, that's pain.
He's basically just tossing people around.
At least he's not killing them. I'm like, the first one, he was like, Bob killed one guy. I think he killed the second guy.
Yeah,
too.
The previous Terminator, because this is
yeah
not
previous
the same
Terminator. It's not the same.
Yeah, part. Put his arm through the guy's torso.
I was like, ooh, fatality. And it's on a guy who's playing Sal Khan. Oh man, that's definitely a fatality.
Right. Yeah. So I guess the different Terminators handle their problems differently, but it's not like this Terminator is afraid to shoot nobody.
He's like, I'm just gonna shoot.
It's just that it wasn't an option at this time. Or maybe as an infiltration unit, it reckoned that it shouldn't start killing people until it's able to find its target. Like, he's supposed to protect John Connor, so he doesn't want to draw too much attention to himself. But he's gonna beat up these motorcycle enthusiasts. he's gonna beat up the people at this bar so he can put on some clothes. So, yeah, I had also looked at the voiceover, which is kind of different from the first movie. It's not a bad voiceover, but it's not entirely necessary. I feel like maybe they could have just explained it better through dialogue instead of through a voiceover. But it doesn't bother me. I just thought it was an interesting choice.
I mean, they did the voiceover like 3-4 times.
Yeah.
I'm like, why are you doing a voiceover? Right. The first time I understand, but then after that, I'm just like, what's with the voiceover? Trying to give us her inner thoughts. I understand, but it's like, do we really need the inner thoughts? I'm pretty sure I can read the emotion on her face about it.
Or they could have done it through dialogue, which I think probably would have been, especially the second voiceover when she was describing the relationship between the Terminator and her son. They could have did that through dialogue because there were other people there. They were there with her old friend where they threw the weapon. So.
They know what she's going through. Right. She can talk to them.
Right, right. Well, maybe, I don't know. Maybe they don't. Maybe they do.
Like I said, with the second part, you can read the emotion on her face where she's going, I don't trust him to. I sort of trust him now. Just a little bit.
Right, right, right. So, I liked that scene. I like the scene where, when the other Terminator came through, I like that how they were careful to hide that they were both Terminators. They so when the second one came through, he attacked a police officer, but it didn't show him take his clothes. It just kind of
morphed or something.
No, but yeah, we don't see that.
Yeah, we don't see that.
We don't know
what
that
he can
happened.
Do.
Right, right. So they set it up so that you assume that the Terminator, the Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator, the T-800, he's still got the same mission of killing Sarah Connor and her son, or maybe just there to kill John Connor. But it's like they're trying to hide it. But we get a clue is that he doesn't kill anybody at the bar. And the second clue is that they're playing Bad to the Bone, which is more like hero music than it is villain music. Like, it doesn't feel as menacing, right? They kind of telegraph it. And then with this, when the second Terminator came through, he's a more regular sized person, but we don't see him doing all of his special things that he can do. So one minute you see he's naked, and the other minute you see that he's got the police officer's clothes on. So you assume that he just took it from the police officer, and later on, you know, you learn what it can really do. So I like that. I like that they tried to be clever with it. And some people were not fooled. I think I was totally fooled when I first saw it. I think I don't remember if I saw it in the movie theater or if I saw it on video. But yeah, they was like, yeah, they got me. They got me. I'm fooled. So this wasn't your first time seeing it, or was it?
No, it was not my first time. Okay. I remember seeing this movie before.
Okay. Yeah, we usually try to see movies that Zach hadn't seen before, but the specific reason that I wanted to watch this movie was because of the similarities that it had to Black Adam. Black Adam had borrowed a lot of elements from this movie. So you know what elements I'm talking about now?
The anti-heroism?
No, not that. I don't even really see Terminator as an anti-hero. It's the relationship that the Terminator had to the boy, the same as Black Adam had to the little boy in the Black Adam movie.
Oh, yeah.
It was almost exactly the same. It's like, because when I was watching the movie, because even Black Adam kind of acts like the Terminator, where he's sort of emotionless and distant. So getting back to what we liked about the movie, we get to see jacked Sarah Connor, right? She's totally jacked out. She's super muscular in this movie. She's doing pull-ups when you first see her. Right, right. And threatening the doctor, becoming hyper-violent when absolutely necessary.
Also, it's also like a little twist. You know, you didn't expect them to be separated at first because Sarah's is in a institute. And John is living with foster parents. It's like, and also John has a history record. Cause as you see, talking about what's the issue now, officer? It's like, he has a criminal record. Even when the T-1000 went on the computer, look up John's name, he's in the records. And I'm like, oh wow, this kid is in trouble.
Right, right.
Wow.
Right. He's a frequent flyer with the criminal justice system.
I'm like, that's completely shocking.
So what else did you like about the movie?
So it's when they're basically getting chased and then John is trying to figure out what's going on. Like, he already put together that, you know, that the T-800 is there to protect him. But he's like, what in the world? Why is this happening? And I was like, my mom was not insane. Oh my God.
Right.
She wasn't insane. I hated her for that.
Right. I did like that. There were a lot of chase scenes in this movie. By the time the Terminator rescues John, you realize that it's not there to kill John, and that the other guy, it's not a human. He's actually an advanced Terminator, the T-1000. So I like the subtle subversion of their own tropes that they established in the first movie. We had this gigantic Terminator machine going around killing people. Now, and then you had the skinny, normal-shaped human protecting the humans. And then in the in this movie, they kind of flip it all around, where you have the giant dude protecting the humans from the small, normal-sized person.
I mean, it's just sort of the Skynet. It was like, okay, this one didn't work. We're going to make a new one. We're going to send one that back in time. This has to work, because there's no way for them to squish it. It's made out of liquid metal. It's going to work. It's going to work. Nothing can go wrong. Right, even if they sent back the old version, nothing can go wrong.
Right. I like the chase scenes. They had a lot of chase scenes in there. The first one is the tractor trailer. Well, actually, the first one really is when the T-1000 finds John Connor and starts chasing John
in the mall.
Right.
First is in the arcade of the mall, then in where regular people are not allowed to go, only employees about the back rooms.
The utility
area. Yeah, utility area. Next, you know, John's on his bike trying to get away. The T-1000 is like, I can still chase you, kid.
Right.
Ends up jacking a truck. Then a chase scene happens with John on a motorcycle. It's like a dirt bike, really.
Right.
And the T-1000 in a truck continually to chase him, even though John is I don't know what they're called.
He's in a canal.
And it's like T-1's like, I don't care. Still driving a truck. I'm like, normally that wouldn't work, but since it's a movie, it kind of works.
Right. And the other thing is that it would have been tore up, but at the same time, it would have caught up with the dirt bike long before it got to the canal, because dirt bikes aren't that fast, and a tractor trailer is designed to go at highway speed. So, you know, tractor trailers can go 70 miles per hour. So there's no way that the dirt bike could have outrun the tractor trailer. If it's just going straight. But you know, it's the movie, and you just there to enjoy it. It's fine. But the other thing is, it was that chase. Oh, excuse me. And then it was the other chase where now when the T-800 catches up to the chase is already in progress. The T-800 is on a proper motorcycle and catches up. The whole thing where he catches up to the tractor trailer and then goes past the tractor trailer and picks up John off of the dirt bike just as the dirt bike was getting run over. That was glorious. And then my favorite thing is when the T-800 is cocking the shotgun. He's cocking it with one hand.
Yeah, cocking it. Still driving the motor. He's basically twirling it as he's doing it. I'm like,
right.
I feel like that's physically impossible, but since you're a cyborg, that's completely fair game.
Not only is it possible, but it caused some issues and complications.
It's like, first of all, how are you reloading the thing itself? Because I'm pretty sure.
Well, it's preloaded. It's
preloaded. Those,
yeah,
okay.
It's already got 5 or 6 shots in there. So it's just like in a video game. So
how many shots did he use? I know he used 3 on the gauge, 2.
Well, if you're going to start counting rounds, and then you're just defeating the purpose.
That's what I'm doing. That's what I'm saying.
You're defeating the purpose of the movie. So anyways, but it was probably 6. But yeah, he just cocked it by twirling around. That just looked cool. But it was real, but it was difficult to pull off. Most of the effects that they use are practical effects, but it was the only real digital effects they used was in a T-1000, which was revolutionary at the time. So another part that I like was the when they actually ended the chase by destroying the truck. So, you know, you watch a lot of movies. Most of the time you'll see a car crash and it'll immediately explode. And most of this is unrealistic because, you know, vehicles just don't explode just because they hit something. But in this movie, at least they showed the spark that lighted the fuel. So I really appreciated that.
Yeah, they also almost pulled a Terminator 1. It was like, oh yeah, it's crashed. Oh no, he's coming out of the fire. Nope, now it's just a tire wheel. Right. Then he actually does come out of the fire. It's like, interesting. He waited.
Right, right, right. He gets a little he gets razzled a little bit. what else do you like?
The whole Sarah Connor scene when she has to escape. They're basically questioning him. Okay, like, we know this one came in this time at the police station and shot up a whole lot of police officers. And he was just spotted recently in the mall. We know you know this guy. Tell us what he's after. And she's just looking like out of it.
Right, right, right.
And she's faking it too, just so she can get a bobby pin, hide it, and use it to break out later. See, and again, the movie showed up like, oh yeah, there's some weirdos. Even the officers are weirdos, because the officer that was tying her to the bed randomly just licked her face. And I was like, you are so
not
weird.
Not an officer. He was an orderly.
I was like, you are so weird.
And why are orderly so weird and creepy? it's almost like 100% of the time they're weird and creepy. Like in like when I saw that, the first thing that I thought of was Kill Bill. You remember Kill Bill?
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, another weird and creepy orderly. Just, what is it with these people? Makes you wonder if this must happen all the time.
That's what it feels like. I'm like, that's just weird. And oh no, again, she breaks out, goes into the story closet, breaks a broom, wait for the same guy that lick her face to show up, beat him down. I was like, oh, that's revenge.
Oh, that first hit was brutal. He was not prepared for that hit. She hit him so hard. She broke the stick on his head. It was bad.
Hit him a couple of times, and then it's like, okay, drag him off, lock him away, continue to try to find a way to escape. Finds the doctor that basically wouldn't let her, you know, out for being on good behavior for 6 months.
They not let her out, but let her go to a less secure facility.
And she was like, this is revenge. Knocks the one guy. She hits him a couple of times in the chest. I'm like, I'm pretty sure you already, you know, dazed him from the first hit. You could have just knocked him in the head. But no, she just kept going in the chest until she was fully in. Because first she threw the keys as a distraction. I was like,
that was brilliant.
That was a good distraction. Just repeatedly hit him in the stomach, knocked him down. I don't know what they used to daze people, but that's what she grabbed, stuck him in the butt with the needle. He was like, oh, yeah, he took his medicine. Then grabbed a bottle of whatever while also breaking the doctor's hand. Because he was like, ah, my hand. Like,
yeah, the doctor was trying to sound the silent.
I was like, you know, you deserve that hand to be broken.
She hit the crap out of his hand.
I know I'm backing, but I love how she asked him when they first revealed her. She was like, how's the knee? He was like, yeah, when I, you know, questioned her, she stabbed me with my pen in the knee. I'm like, Jesus.
Yeah, she is not taking any guff. She gets that. She puts the serum, whatever it is. It's like Drano.
Yeah, whatever she has in there, puts it up to his neck.
She didn't put it. No.
No, she put the needle in his neck.
Yeah, she put the needle in his neck. And then she had a plumber on her hand. So all she had to do was squeeze it and fill his body with Drano or something. Because she already had the needle in his neck.
Yeah, and she was like, yeah, that's a hostage situation. Telling the officer to open the door, telling the other two guys to drop their weapons, go back, go inside, stop the one guy, but like, no, you open the door, lay down, open the door, hold the door open.
Right, right, right.
Face the wall. Walk out, but then she gets attacked by another guy. But, you know, she fights it out, runs away, had to unlock one door, get through it, lock it back up, get to the other door, unlock that one, but break the key in it before she locked it, which was smart because they can't do jack.
Right, right.
And so, which made them had to go all the way back around. I'm like, yeah, you got to make a huge U-turn. Meanwhile, John and the T-800 are on their way to her. Also, the funniest part about that part was when John was like, you're supposed to do anything I say? Correct. Stand on one leg, does that. And I was like, oh, wow, he's supposed to do anything he says. And before that even happened, John was yelling, "Help, let me go." Two other guys come over to see what's going on. And because they called him, I forgot what they called him. It wasn't Pipsqueak. It was something else. But then it was something else. I can't remember. But because of that, he was like, "Okay, lower your leg. Grab him." T-800 grabs one guy, lift him up. The other guy goes around the T-800 to grab him from behind. That didn't work well. Ended up breaking his arm, about to kill him. John's like, "No."
Yeah, he pulls out his pistol.
He was like, "Yo, yeah," he was ready to kill.
No, and here's the thing.
He was about to say, "No witnesses."
He pulled out the pistol and fired it, but John moved his hand out of the way just before he pulled the trigger. So, he's like, "What are you doing? You was going to kill that guy." "Of course.
I'm a Terminator." He was like, "No killing people." "Okay." "No, swear it." "What?" "Put up your hand and say, 'I swear I won't kill anyone. I swear I won't kill anyone.'"
Right.
They get to the front gate. The officer's like, "Your visiting hours aren't, you know, are over. What are you doing here?" Shoots him, pull out his pistol again. Of course, the officer does the same. And then he ends up shooting the police officer in both the knees. So I'm like, "What the heck?" He's like, "I didn't kill him. He'll survive." I'm like, just still.
He's like, "He'll live.
He'll live." I'm like, "Yeah, sure."
Yeah, that was his main tactic. He was just... After he was told he didn't want to, John didn't want him to kill people, he just started shooting people. He just started shooting police officers in the kneecaps.
In the kneecaps, in the shoulder, in the hand. As long as they didn't shoot him in anything else, it was all safe and fine.
Right, 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 right. As long as they were all, they were left alive. That was the parameter. And what really tripped me out is like, whenever John would tell him not to kill people, the Terminator had this look on his face. It's like, "But killing people is my jam. Come on. I can't kill people.
It's one of my primary things that I am programmed to do."
Right.
"I am programmed to kill people.
Killing people is what I do. That's how I was made. Come on. That's, you're killing me here."
Yeah, they say, Sarah, they get out, but then this is the second chase scene where they're getting chased by the T-1000. They're in the cop car driving backwards. Sarah is shooting the pistol. Terminator is driving the cop car backwards while shooting the shotgun. John's only job is to give Sarah another reload for the pistol. And the second job was to reload a shotgun.
Right. So that was awesome, because then you really get to see. What's really nice is that, like, when the T-1000 gets out of hospital in the first place. And then, like, he's disguising himself as different people, killing them along the way.
Like, yeah, first he disguised himself. He's already disguised as a cop. Then he disguised himself as John's guardian mother. And it's like, oh, yeah, she's already there. Because John's like, she's never this nice.
Right.
And T-1000 is like, "Hold on, let me see that." Mimics his voice. It's like, yeah, that's that. Yeah, they're dead.
Right. Yeah, because when the T-800 mimics John's voice, he asked about the dog, like, "What's the dog name?" "The dog name is Rafi," and he's like, "Or something." And then,
yeah, and then he's like, "Woofy, like,
what's Woofy? What's going on?" He's like, "I don't know what's wrong with that dog. Come on home." And he's like, "Your parents are dead." And then you see the scene where, it's like, I don't even know what happened to his foster mother, but somehow the T-1000 came in, killed the foster mother right away, and then mimicked her. And then, so now his foster father is walking around not knowing that his wife is dead, and then the other woman, the woman that he thinks is his wife, is a robot. And then like, he's asking her questions while she's on the phone, and then she switches hands. And the next thing you know, he stops talking, but you don't see what happened. And then when the camera pulls away, and the T-1000's arm had become like this metal spike sword that cuts him, that impales him through the milk carton that he was holding, and then through his mouth, his open mouth, through the back of his head, against the wall. Like, just a brutal scene. And then when he gets to the hospital, there's one part where people are walking on the floor, and he disguised himself
as the floor.
And then he starts to reconstitute himself into a human shape. That was brilliant piece of technology. Whenever they talk about this movie, that was one of, well, when they talking about the technical aspects and the special effects, that's one of the scenes they show all the time, is him bringing himself up from the floor. And if you notice, it has a checkerboard pattern. There's the black and white tiles. What's interesting is that the floor was originally, it was white. And so the film crew made them black and white tiles so they can pull off this effect. So he reconstitutes, he starts chasing the T-800, Sarah Connor, John Connor. He does this thing where he gets to the elevator and he turns his hands into these spikes to get into the elevator. And then that's when the T-800 points the shotgun at his head.
Point blank.
And point blank. That and blows his head open. That paused him for a minute. And he puts them back together and he continues to chase. That's just, I liked the relentlessness and how both Patrick, I'm trying to think of the actor's name, Robert Patrick, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, how they remained that emotionless manner, right, in playing robots or cyborgs. So that was pretty awesome. So also we talked about, when you talk about Sarah Connor's escape, one of the things that made me think about is the lockpicking lawyer. Have you seen those videos?
No. No, I mean, I've seen some of his videos before.
Right, yeah. Right. So it was like she was picking the lock and I was thinking, man, it's like now I'm looking at it in a whole new light because I've been watching a bunch of his videos. I love those videos. They're only like between 2 and 5 minutes. And sometimes it's like a video is like, there's one video that he did where he had this $300, I think it was a door lock, like a lock that you're supposed to install to secure your front door. It was $300. It's supposed to be compatible with Apple and iPhone, so you can use your iPhone to lock and unlock your door. And he was able to open it up with a simple rake attack. So basically, he took a special key and he raked the lock, because all the electronics lock have a backup where you can use a regular key. So he opened up the lock to expose the backup, where you stick the backup cylinder, and he just raked it a few times and the door opened right up. Like, they had no, I was like, oh my God, that's like no security. The lock cost $300 and they couldn't get a better cylinder. He says the good thing is that you can replace the cylinder, so you don't have to use a cylinder that actually comes with the lock. But the problem is that it's $300. You paying $300 for it, you would expect better security, where you don't feel like you got to replace locks right away. So anyway, that's now whenever I see a lock picking scene in a movie, that's where my mind goes. I was like, yep, totally possible.
And she used a bobby pin to unlock her way out of the restraints, pin to get out of her room.
Right.
You guys have no security whatsoever.
Right. Well, at least, like, she had to work, because she was using the bobby pins and not, you know, real lock picking tools, at least she had to work at it, right? Yeah. So it's not like it was super easy. I'm not even exactly sure that bobby pins would work, since, you know, bobby pins, they bend real easily. So would that have really worked? I don't know. Maybe I'll watch a video on YouTube to find out if that's real. But it's like, when you sit back and enjoy the movie, it's not that big of a deal to me. And so what other parts did you like?
Well, we already went over the chase scene. That was, what was it? I want to say when they get to her friends, her Hispanic friends.
Right.
And they're like, okay, you two on gun duty, I'm just going to do what I got to do. And she goes to sleep while watching, you know, her friends enjoy their playtime. And she has this dramatic dream where she's behind a steel gate. And she can't, like, you can't hear her voice, but you can hear the steel gate being shook. While on the other side, it's an alternative version of herself where none of this stuff happens. She's living her normal life because she's wearing her dress clothes. And she's basically trying to warn herself to run away because of the bomb that's going to go off. And I'm like, watching nuclear bomb videos on how it can hit. I'm like, yeah, the radiation of the heat wave, oh, yeah, that's going to melt no matter how far you, like, depending on how far you are, oh, yeah, that's going to melt. I was like, yeah, yeah, that was, but it was also graphic, too, because not only is her alternative self is being burnt to a crisp, but her other side, herself on the other wall, or cage, whatever, is also being burnt. I'm like, oh, man, that's right. Graphic.
Yeah, everybody is this bright light, and then everybody just burns away. It was, yeah, it's pretty, it's a disturbing dream for certain. So, yeah, she had a dream, and then what her plan was to have the Terminator take her son further south, and she was going to go and find Dyson because they had talked about
who made it,
right?
How long, what went down when they made it,
right? So who made Cyberdyne, or who made it possible for Cyberdyne to control all the defense systems? And who made it possible that this terrible future can happen? And then when the Terminator tells her, that's when she decides she's going to kill that one dude, and that will basically, in her mind, prevent everything. But when she drives all the way there, John with the Terminator figure out what she's up to, so they basically chase after her. But she gets there first, and she has an M16 with a scope, so she was going to kill him, but then it's like he was distracted by his son just in time, and she ended up hitting the computer instead, and then she just started opening up with the M16.
She just started opening up. I'm like, Sarah, do you not care if there's someone else in that room?
It seemed like not. But then at the last minute, she ended up getting into the house, and she had a pistol because she used up all of her rifle ammo. But then when she was up close and personal with him, and his family was trying to protect him, she realized what she was doing. And then it was at this moment that her son had caught up with her and was basically trying to snap her out of trying to just kill some dude in cold blood. And then they kind of talked it out with the dude, this family. And, you know, he was like, man, you just trying to judge me or something. I haven't even done yet. And it was like, well, now we got to destroy everything in the lab. They got to destroy all of his work, all the evidence that his work was based on, because he still had items from the original Terminator that came back for her in 1984. He had the Terminator's
arm and computer chip.
Right. The arm and computer chip. So that was another great action sequence when they had to go into into the building, and the guy was like, now you know the rules, now you're not supposed to bring past visitor hours, and everybody pulled their gun out. So that's when they started going in and started setting up, and the action sequence when all the police came was like, who's out there? How many police are out there? Like, yeah, all of them. So that was a great sequence.
I would say also another good that was awesome, and you know, again, disturbing, is when John Connor had to take the little boy up to his room, told it to him, okay, show them. So he takes a knife, cuts his arm open, and rips the skin off to show the exoskeleton. I'm like, oh yeah, that's
the endoskeleton.
I'm like, yeah, that would traumatize someone.
Right.
But then the guy's like, oh my God, I basically made you. Oh, this is...
Well, not that he made it, but he recognized it as the same...
Yeah, as the same arm that's in the lab.
Right.
And, you know, by telling him what happened, he was able to put two and two together. And so was my... She was like, he took it pretty well. No, he did not. He did. Right. He was like, I feel like I'm going to puke. He did not take that well.
Right. So the other thing that happened was... So after that entire action sequence, with basically the Terminator either shooting the police in the kneecaps or gassing them with their own,
tear gas.
Right, gassing them with the tear gas, or blowing up the police cars and trying to, you know, follow the new parameters of not killing people.
Do not kill people.
And then they make their way out. Then they start getting chased by the T-1000 again. But one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when the T-1000, he's on his motorcycle in the building, and then he jumps out of the building with the motorcycle onto a nearby helicopter, and then he breaks into the helicopter, pours himself in, and then he looks at the pilot, right, of the helicopter, and says, get out.
Get out. Like, yep, I'm getting out.
I'm high in the air, and the fall might kill me, but I'm getting out of here.
I was like, wow, at least he didn't kill this one. Kind of. Technically, he didn't kill. He just told him to get out.
Right, right, right.
Truck driver, nah, pulled out. Anyone else, stab, cut, whatever, gone. This time, get out. I'm like, why are you being polite now?
Right, right, right. So, and then the final action sequence when they get to the liquid metal plant and the action sequence that happens there. So, yeah, just, I like the pacing of it and how it goes from action sequence to action sequence and without getting dull, boring, and tiring. So it was one of the reasons, one of my favorite movies. So what did you think of the Terminator 2? Yeah,
of course I liked it. It was a good movie.
It was a good movie? Just yes. A good movie?
You know what I mean by good. Don't try it.
All right. So that's it for talking about our favorite parts. And up next is the trivia.
All right, so Robert Patrick undertook a righteous running regime and practiced breathing only through his nose in order to appear to be a cyborg that could run at high speeds without soaring fatigue. He had trained so hard that he was able to catch up to Edward Furlong on his dirt bike with ease.
Right, so that's the funny part. Like, in the movie, it shows that as a Terminator, he could not catch up with the dirt bike. But in real life, he can actually catch up with the dirt bike. So maybe they could have rewrote that scene where he actually catches up and it knocks him off his bike, but then the John is able to get away anyway. But that's actually kind of funny. Production took sufficiently long that Edward Furlong's growth caused the production team to have to make certain adjustments during the shoot. He is noticeably younger in the desert scene than in other scenes. His voice began to break and had to be pitch adjusted in post-production. He had also grown quite tall over the months that for one scene shot late in the production schedule, he had to stand in a hole in the ground in order to maintain continuity and height difference with Linda Hamilton. So that's funny.
Right, Linda Hamilton's twin sister, Leslie Hamilton Garin?
Looks like Garin.
Yeah, Garin was used as a double in scenes involving two Sarah Connors. For example, when a T-1000 was imitating her and in a scene not in the theatrical release, but on the DVD as a mirror image of Linda.
Yeah, so that's pretty awesome. And when they was fighting in the metal mm-hmm. place, that was Linda.
Yeah,
Linda Hamilton and her twin sister.
Oh, yeah, that was like, yeah, that is spot on identical. I was like, to the cheekbones and all. I was like, yeah, that's too identical.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. According to director James Cameron, Linda Hamilton suffered permanent hearing damage in one ear during the elevator shootout because she did not replace her earplugs after removing them between takes.
Oh, she should have done that. That was...
Oh, yeah. Ouch, that hurts.
The effect of the T-1000 freezing and breaking up was achieved by filming shots of an amputee filtered with prosthetics and of Robert Patrick with his real limbs burned underneath the set. Clever editing makes the effect appear almost seamless.
Yeah, so... That was pretty cool scene. He's trying to walk and he's breaking apart as he's walking. that was a cool scene. So for the Los Angeles River sequence, Arnold Schwarzenegger was in pain because he could not wear a glove while cocking the gun. So his fingers would get stuck in the mechanism. He tore the skin from his fingers and hand many times before he mastered it. And he frequently hit Edward Furlong with the gun while doing it. One time, almost knocking the young actor out. He had to achieve all this while trying to act and control a Harley at the same time as James Cameron told him where to look. He could not dart his eyes either because it would have ruined the shot. Shooting the gates also took weeks of practice because he had to also act cool while doing it. So, yeah, that's a lot. So like when I told you when it was realistic, it was just difficult. That's what I was talking about. He was chewing up his hands as he was trying to cock this gun the way you see it done in the movie. So yeah, it was pretty difficult.
Arnold Schwarzenegger was given a slightly used Gulfstream 3 airplane worth about $14 million in the U.S. by producer Mario Casar for accepting the role in this film. He was like, you know, I'm going to give you this plane just because you accepted the role. It's slightly used, but I'm going to give you this plane.
Yeah, this gently used plane. Now, as far as hiring a pilot and the fuel, that's all on
that,
you.
That's on you. I'm just giving you the plane.
Caraco Studios executives were nervous and concerned when the original budget of $75 million ballooned up to $88 million, with more to come. In order to keep the budget manageable, they proposed to eliminate a few scenes, particularly the opening biker bar scenes where the Terminator is introduced. They tried to get Arnold Schwarzenegger to persuade James Cameron to remove the scene, but Schwarzenegger turned down, saying, only a studio guy would cut a scene like that.
Yeah, of course, only a studio person would. Like anyone else, like, no, what? That's awesome. Keep that in. Hush your mouth.
They're not thinking artistically. There was something else that had happened too. I think it was in this movie where James Cameron figured that maybe he could remove every third frame or something like that. But film doesn't work like that, so he couldn't do that. And he just ended up with a scene with a movie that would have just been like, it looked like a bad computer game. That's why that didn't work. So he couldn't do that.
Industrial Light and Magic Computer Graphics Department had to grow from 6 artists to almost 36 to accumulate at all the work required to bring the T-1000 to life, costing $5.5 million and taking 8 months to produce, which ultimately amounted to 3.5 minutes of screen time.
$5.5 million for, and
how that's many artists?
36.
Yeah, 36
graphic artists for 3.5 minutes.
I mean, hey, that's. They work.
Right.
They made it work.
Well, that's Academy Award work right there. Special effects guru Stan Winston and his crew studied hours of nuclear test footage in order to make Sarah Connor's nuclear nightmare scene look as realistic as possible. A miniature Los Angeles was made to simulate the scene. Some of the materials used in the miniature that mimicked all the destroyed masonry were Mitchell's crackers and shredded wheat. After each take, it would take an average of 2 days to set the model up to shoot again. In late 1991, members of several U.S. federal nuclear testing labs had unofficially declared it the most accurate depiction of a nuclear blast ever created for a fictional movie picture. The special effects team members have stated several times that no scene they've worked on since has received an equivalent amount of praise or emotional feedback from viewers.
Like I said, when you look at videos on YouTube about nuclear explosion and what the cause and effect is, oh yeah, that's the cause and effect like they had in the movie.
Right.
In the audio commentary, director James Cameron said that not only was the biker bar scene filmed across the street from where LAPD officers beat up
Rodney King,
but they were filming the night of the beating. Cameron got the idea for Strange Days that came out in 1995 after the outcome of the verdict on April 29th, 1992.
So you know about the Rodney King beating?
No. I don't believe not so.
Okay. So this is the film was released in 1991. So the beating probably took place in 1990 or probably earlier than that. So anyways, there was a motorist named Rodney King, and for some reason he was stopped by police. Nowadays everybody has cameras. Everybody have access to cameras. So anytime somebody's doing something, you know, they whip the camera out. And like when you flip on YouTube, you see a bunch of videos of like police misconduct, or you see it in a court case, so they'll say like 6 months ago these police officers beat this man or whatever, and they tried to hide a video, but then it inevitably gets out in the public. But back in the early 90s, there was no such thing as everybody having a camera. So this dude just happened to have a camcorder, because like if you wanted to record video, you have to have a big chunky camcorder. something about the size of a, I don't know, a boombox. Something the size of a small boombox. And he just happened to be filming, I guess, the city. And then he came across this beating by accident. So what you see is that there are a bunch of police officers and they're surrounding this one black motorist. And they're just beating him with nightsticks. He doesn't have a weapon or anything. He's just on the ground, just being beat. And beaten to the within an inch of his life. And so this guy who took this video, he took it to the news station. And that's how it got kind of blown up. It went viral before we understood what going viral meant in the early 90s. And all the news stations were playing this video. And there was a whole bunch of hubbub with the Los Angeles Police Department. So there was a huge event, Spike Lee, he had used that video as, he had used footage of the video in the very beginning of his movie, Malcolm X, and it was the subject of debate for decades, really. But then, this is when the narrative of, they'll say one bad apple or a few bad apples or something like that. Because people refused to believe that it was a widespread problem that was happening all the time and constantly. but now we have a better idea of how widespread the problem is. So anyway, yeah, that was a thing. That was a thing that happened. So moving right along. Stunt pilot Charles A. Tamburo, who plays the unfortunate pilot who was forced to jump out of his helicopter by the T-1000, also performed the stunt where the helicopter flies under an overpass in the final chase scene. The camera car would be driving the Steadicam operator close to the helicopter to capture the close-up shots, but the camera crew refused to film it because of the high risk involved. Director James Cameron filmed the shot himself twice, once with the camera car driving behind the helicopter and once in front of it.
He said, you're like, y'all are too scared to do it? Fine. I'll do it myself. Right. Gotta hire myself to do the job. Unbelievable.
It's not unbelievable. The crew was like, nah, that ain't safe.
That's too risky.
You wanted to drive under helicopter while the helicopter's driving under the overpass. What if the pilot ain't that good? All he has to do is nick the piece of the overpass.
And Cameron was like, he's a professional. I trust him, so I'm gonna trust myself. I'm gonna do it myself. Well, and I'm gonna do it twice.
Right.
Do it again.
Yeah. He wanted to put his life on the line. That's all right.
Linda Hamilton learned to pick locks for the scene in the mental hospital, where she does precisely that with a paperclip.
Yeah, we talked about that earlier. A female passerby wandered into the biker bar set, thinking it was real. Despite walking past all the location trucks, cameras, and lights, seeing Arnold Schwarzenegger standing in the bar dressed in only boxer shorts, she finally asked what was going on, only for Schwarzenegger to reply that it was a male stripper night. Whether it was a coincidence or not, in Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines in 2003, the Terminator, played again by Arnold Schwarzenegger, actually steps into a bar during male stripper night.
The fact that she walked through past all the trucks and lights, and I'm like, how are you slightly blind?
Right.
How did you not see the bright lights, the cameras? How is that even possible? But okay, sure.
Right. She was a little bit dizzy, apparently.
In the final scene, the line, "I cannot self-terminate, you must lower me into the steel," were added by Arnold Schwarzenegger in post-production. Originally, Terminator slightly gave Sarah the controls for the Wentz. But the test audience didn't understand why Terminator couldn't just drop himself into the steel.
Right.
Which, yeah, he would have to self-explain that, because it's like, why don't you just jump in?
Right. Yeah, people wouldn't understand why doesn't he just commit suicide? And that's because Terminators don't commit suicide. Terminators, you have to kill a Terminator. I think the most suicide thing that he did was he allowed Sarah to lower him into the pit of molten metal. So that was also how they had shot. That was a nice scene where they shot the T-1000 into the molten metal. So the T-1000 went in first. And then when it went in, it was, screaming in pain. That's just the only way to describe it. And it was basically turning into all the things that it had mimicked before the body of the T-1000 dissolved into the liquid metal.
So it can survive fires, but when it comes to molten lava, oh no, that's gone.
Yeah, that's molten metal. That was, you got broken down to your constituent parts. So that's it for the trivia brought to us by IMDb. And now, up next, we go to what the critics thought. So the critics gave it a 93%, audience gave it a 95% on Rotten Tomatoes, pretty high scores. IMDb reviews gave it a 6.8 out of 10, super high score.
You mean 8.6?
8.6, that's what I meant, 8.6 out of 10. So go ahead and tell us what the first couple of critics thought.
Kenneth Turman from Los Angeles Times, more elaborate than the original, but just as screwily put together, it cleverly combines the most successful elements of its predecessor with a number of new twists to produce one hell of a wild ride.
Yep, I agree. Go ahead, read the next one. All right, one.
Terrence Rafferty,
I think.
Rafferty from New Yorker. The picture is full of spectacle action sequence and dazzling special effects, but the narrative doesn't have the snap of the original. It's lumbering and monotonous, what in the world? And it carries a heavy-handed anti-nuke message.
So by monotonous, he means that it's the same thing over and over again, which I disagree.
I mean, that's the whole point of the Terminator, because the whole entire thing is stuck in a time loop where it never stops. Even though Connor was born, Skynet still exists. Even though they basically destroyed everything, Skynet still exists. It's in a non-ending time loop.
Well, he's just saying that the tone of the movie is, he's trying to describe it as being boring. But like I said, I totally disagree. And then it says it carries a heavy-handed anti-nuke message. What other kind of anti-nuke message is there, right? Like, if you're going to talk about how the devastation of what a nuclear war would bring, it's going to be heavy-handed. And who's the pro-nuclear war people? That's what I want to know.
Apparently
the
him.
Jobs who are all, it was like, yes, nukes.
It's apparently
like,
him.
Apparently so. So, Kerry Rickey, I guess that's how you say it, from the Philadelphia Inquirer said, "Inside Terminator 2 beats a human heart, but its soul is that of a killer machine." And you kind of get that because the T-800, you know, as he goes along in the film, because it's a learning computer.
Yeah. So he's like, learning from what he's experiencing.
Right. So he kind of throws a smile and a wink and whatnot. And there was one time at the very end of the movie when John is helping him up. He says, "I need a vacation."
Oh, yeah.
That was a laugh out loud moment. And finally, Ralph Novak from People Magazine wrote, "Shamefully sadistic, achingly dull, and totally predictable, it rehashes the far superior 1984 original." Now, I will say most of the Terminator films are basically
predictable.
Not predictable. They're basically the same story. Is that something gets sent back in time to kill somebody else and they have to fight against that thing. It's always a chase movie. That's just the style of the movie that it is. And then the only time they tried to do something different was Terminator Salvation. And people still didn't. Like, I actually liked Terminator Salvation, but for some reason it didn't get the acclaim that the other Terminator movies did. But but that's just the style of the movie, you know. You send some back body, it's always has something to do with time travel. Even there was a short-lived TV series called Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles, where they're constantly sending people back in time, right? That was the whole thing with the series. But I guess I just have to disagree with this dude. And also, shamefully sadistic. What kind of critique is that of basically an action horror movie? Which is basically what this is. Especially when you compare it to the first one. Because apparently he likes the first one better. And the first one was specifically a horror movie. So how is that less sadistic, right? What does he mean by shamefully? That's where you go to the movies, especially listen, when you go to an action movie like this, you're gonna see some sadistic things. It's what you signed up for.
I guess he didn't like the scene where Arnold cuts his arm open, or the scene where Sarah gets blown and melted. I'm pretty sure that's what he didn't like.
Yeah. Or when she beats the crap out of that dude that licked her face. He deserved that beating. Come on. Some people, you don't lick people in the face, people. I'm sorry. That's just not how it, not without their consent. You freaks. Anyways, finally, Terminator 2 Judgment Day is, as of this recording, available on HBO Max. That's it for today. Next week. Well, actually, is it next week? Yeah, next week. Yeah. We're doing this next week. Next week, we dive into another one of my favorite movies, a classic in the circles of cinema, and recently featured on Not a Bomb podcast, The Shawshank Redemption. Follow us on Twitter or TikTok at Backlick Cinema, or on Facebook or Instagram at Backlick Cinema Podcast. And if you're on Mastodon, at Backlick Cinema at mstdn.party. That's Mastodon Party. Don't forget that you can contact us with any questions, comments, or suggestions at fanmail@backlickcinema.com. Go ahead, send us a line. Let us know what movies you want us to talk about. Believe me, it matters. Be safe. Share a movie from yesteryear with your family. Hug your loved ones. And if you're going to be anything, be outstanding.